From the Contemporary Art Southeast special publication Artlanta, published in 1977. Quote, "The art activity in Atlanta the last few years can best be described as energetic and grassroots-oriented. It is taking place, for the most part, outside of the old and accepted art establishment, and it is largely the result of the artists themselves organizing and attacking. Artists have secured help from a number of sources, ranging from government to private enterprise, but the tremendous surge in art-related activity has been originated and seen through by the individual artists. Never has the city had the opportunity to see so much art and to see it so easily. It has been moved out to where the public works and lives."
Well, it just gets to a point where you feel as if you have had it. You go along for years because you want to be part of the art world, because art means a great deal to you.
To all of the issues that were going on in the 70s, particularly for women, the personal is political.
We're doing this as a ritual, as an artwork, and as a social statement in order to let people see how beautiful and how meaningful your lives have been and continue to be.
Welcome to Art Worker. I'm Abby Miller. In this series, we've gone back to the 1970s to look at how the local art scene was built in Atlanta, Georgia, through a combination of artist organizing and public funding, and we've recontextualized artists as members of the working class. Today, we're going to look at one more grassroots Atlanta arts organization, the Atlanta Women's Art Collective, and then we're wrapping up this journey on the podcast. But I plan on continuing this research. There's a lot more to learn and a lot more to say. The bigger picture of artists' involvement with the labor movement, the movements for racial and gender equality, and how those movements manifested in Atlanta is missing from this project in its current form. This form of the project was actually made in partial fulfillment of requirement for my master's degree. I'm graduating with my MA in Art and Design with a focus in Museum Studies from Kennesaw State University next month. I began this project 11 months ago, thinking it would be a podcast made in conjunction with an exhibition proposal about Atlanta's art scene in the 1970s. Instead, I now feel like what I have is the beginnings of a much bigger project. And now that I'm on this side of it, and on this side of the first year of Trump's second term in office, I'm questioning a big part of my main argument, that state funding for the arts is a good thing. Ideally, it would be. I still believe that. But the reality of our world, right now anyway, shows the dangers and precarity of reliance upon public funding for the arts. In any case, the other part of my argument, that artists are cultural workers who should be in community and in conversation with other workers, still holds. I guess the question I'm left asking now is, what might it look like if a collective group of workers, including art workers, developed their own power and agency, independent from the state? My little project, postmortem aside, what we've covered here so far is part of a very important story. The Comprehensive Employment and Training Act impacted artists across the country in the 1970s, not just in Atlanta, but it is undeniable that Atlanta would not be the city it is today without CETA-funded jobs for artists. So on that note, let's dive into the last piece of our story here. The city of Atlanta opened up a world of possibilities to art workers through the creation of CETA-funded jobs in the 1970s. The artists who worked at the Neighborhood Arts Center served as cultural workers who led classes and workshops for the local community. Artists at the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition created an artists' union. They shared resources and educated Atlanta artists on important issues that impacted the whole community. All of these artists were able to dedicate time to their own art practices as well. the heretofore unimagined freedom that artists had to create organizations and plan programming materialized in ways specific to certain identity groups. One such group was women. The art market under capitalism has historically valued the work of white men above other artists, a perennial problem that causes all other artists with intersecting or marginalized identities to be tokenized on the market to this day. This issue was taken up by the second wave feminist movement, which ignited across the United States in the 1960s and helped create the women's art movement, or the feminist art movement. As Atlanta artist Julia Fenton said,
"This is when the feminist women's movement was started, and it was very much, we were very much aware of the fact that we were not getting shown and we were not getting paid. So that kind of politics was going on."
Class and gender politics compounded on women art workers, and so they began to organize. Well-known groups and galleries were established in major cities, like Soho 20 Gallery in New York, established in 1973, and Women Artists in Revolution, which formed in 1969, in part as a reaction to the male-dominated art workers' coalition in New York City. Interestingly, the economic need to advocate for women artists went hand in hand with women striving to break the man-made mold for what contemporary art should be. So-called women's work, craft art, and performance art became popular art labor skills adopted by women artists. The public support that Atlanta artists were getting from the city provided fertile ground for a small group of women who wanted to develop their art practices in community with other women. In September of 1976, the Atlanta Women's Art Collective, referred to by its members as AWAC, was formed by four members of the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition at almost the exact same time that the coalition took shape. Callahan McDonough, Lee Sokol, Gail Lineback, and Daryl Sharwell were preoccupied with the question, where are the women artists in Atlanta, and how are they doing? They started contacting other women art workers and, in the process, realized that what they wanted most of all was connection with other women. In fall of 1977, they held a meeting with women they recruited from their various networks. They discussed the appeal of joining a group of women artists, and they talked about what they wanted the purpose of the group to be. Some attendees were cautious, stating that they liked the idea of joining a women's group, but they didn't want to get involved with anything too political. Others expressed that joining a feminist art group felt important to them, but they didn't want the collective to dictate any particular artistic style or medium to them. The meeting concluded and 23 women in attendance decided to join. This would remain the core of the Atlanta Women's Art Collective throughout the group's existence.
The core was in town people primarily in our late 20s to, you know, mid to late 30s. And we lived, you know, in Little Five Points and Lake Clair, Candler Park, Midtown, and that's where a lot of it was happening.
It was a great period for bubbling up for our rights and our interests. And so there were a bunch of organizations that got started.
Finding and articulating a group identity became an ongoing concern for AWAC members. The collective was intentionally small. They prioritized intimacy and felt they could best preserve intimate connections within the collective by capping membership. They were also quite open about the range of political leanings among members, from radical feminist to liberal and on to conservative. Despite political affiliations, and despite some members' initial inability to see the inherently political underpinnings of the need for a women's art group in the first place, in correspondence and promotional materials, the collective repeatedly maintained that they were committed to feminism and art. The group would become more consciously and overtly feminist as it progressed. Economic conditions women art workers faced could not be ignored for long. As members of the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition, some of the very first exhibitions Atlanta Women's Art Collective artists participated in, from 1976 to 1977, were coalition shows. While these were meaningful opportunities for members of the Atlanta Women's Art Collective to show their work, members also wanted to experience art made by women through exhibitions organized by women. To turn this into a reality, they knew they would have to make it happen themselves. The Atlanta Women's Art Collective's initial goals were to educate, support, and promote women artists. To accomplish these goals, they educated themselves on contemporary issues impacting women art workers specifically. In 1977, a small group of AWAC members traveled to the National Women's Conference in Houston, Texas, where they heard from other women artists about the troubles they often faced while trying to exhibit their work. They became acutely aware of the omission of women artists from art history and how this prevented one from understanding her own work in a historical context. In light of these experiences, AWAC members soon expanded upon their initial ambitions for the collective and began working on them, setting out to create exhibition space and opportunities for local women artists, but also planning workshops and networking events for members, and bringing feminist artists to Atlanta for exhibitions and lectures. The first major exhibition that AWAC organized was done in conjunction with the International Women's Conference in Atlanta in May 1977. This show, Works by the Atlanta Women's Art Collective, was installed in a vacant storefront of an old building in Atlanta's Peachtree Walk District. Members of the collective did necessary renovations and prep to make the space appropriate for an art exhibition. In a 2015 oral history interview, AWAC founder Callahan McDonough recalled,
"But it was a time that we would capitalize on things like vacant storefronts, and we'd ask if we could have an exhibition there. Like our first exhibition, we had to go in and sheetrock, paint it, do the lighting. It was a space that actually was a storefront. It became a gallery at one point, right on Peachtree, around Peachtree and Fifth. We did all of the refreshments ourselves. We did all the work ourselves. We did all the graphic design and printing ourselves for the invitation. And I think the total expense, and it was probably mostly postage and the paper for the invitation, was $200. And we probably had, I would say maybe 1,200 people. They were spilling out into the street on Peachtree. You could hardly move around."
What they accomplished was one of the most successful, well-attended exhibitions put on by an independent arts organization in Atlanta in the 1970s. Famed Atlanta gallerist David Heath described the exhibition as, quote, "one of the best alternative shows presented to date in Atlanta," unquote. The exhibition had been sponsored by Contemporary Art Southeast, the publication, and the Bureau of Cultural and International Affairs. The overwhelming success of the show ensured continued support for AWAC from Atlanta organizations and government agencies. In July of 1977, AWAC put in an application with the City of Atlanta for a CETA-funded position so that the collective could hire an artist in residence to conduct research on women artists in Atlanta. This project would involve conducting interviews with art workers and would culminate in a publication with an accompanying exhibition. Additionally, the project aspired to assist in correcting the error of women art workers being neglected by art historians for so long. Laura Vandenberg was hired for the position, which covered 1 year of wages through CETA. Vandenberg approached the project as a dialogue between herself and her interviewees and expressed a desire to document the art practices of contemporary Southern women, saying, quote, "I want to know who we are, what we do, and what we want." She sent a series of surveys out and compiled the responses from approximately 175 women. The result was the exhibition Mappings, a Survey of Atlanta Women Artists, held at the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition Gallery in 1978. With this body of work, the Atlanta Women's Art Collective attempted to articulate their group identity once and for all. They came away noticing their individual differences, both political and aesthetic, were more distinct than ever, but felt comfortable with the dynamic picture that emerged. They decided that the diversity of the group was their identity. Over the following years, AWAC members continued to organize well-received exhibitions and lectures with visiting artists. The collective opened their doors to include non-member women artists in the 1978 exhibition, 36 Women Artists, which they published a catalog for. In 1979, AWAC hosted a Visiting Women Artist series and invited feminist art movement figures Mary Beth Edelson and Nancy Spiro to each give lectures and show their work in an exhibition. Atlanta Women's Art Collective members even organized an installation of Judy Chicago's dinner party at the Fox Theater in 1982. AWAC identified a problem for women art workers, that they lacked support, especially in the Southeast, but also that they felt pressure to articulate a shared identity as women in art production. The collective was able to produce exhibitions and programming through the support they received from the City of Atlanta and through CETA-funded positions. And a great deal of the programming AWAC put on would benefit art students at Georgia State University and the Atlanta College of Art, RIP. However, throughout the process of organizing programming, AWAC members realized they wouldn't find the unifying, shared identity they were searching for. What united them was an intersection of their regional, gender, and class identities. They were all women art workers, choosing to work and create in solidarity, making art in the American South.
And so we had written a grant to bring New York artists and women artists from other parts of the country to Atlanta, and we did some exchange projects with other women too. Like we did an exchange with Artists in Residence, AIR, in New York. We had a gallery at one point, the Women's Art Collective did on 10th and Peachtree. And we had Miriam Shapiro and Nancy Spiro and Mary Beth Edelson. And each one of them did a workshop with us. We produced something out of it. We hung a show of their work. We did a catalog, and they did a presentation out of that grant.
You know, and joined the Atlanta Women's Art Collective, which was founded about the same time, so I got radicalized with that. Callahan McDonough managed to get us an invitation to go to the first International Women's Year Conference in Houston, which was astonishing. But it was fascinating. It was absolutely wonderful. I was so proud to be there. It was just an incredible experience. And so the Women's Art Collective was a very important mover and shaker.
The Atlanta Women's Art Collective brought the feminist art movement into the Southeast and into Atlanta through their exhibitions and programming. They invited the Atlanta art community and the public into the dialogue they were having in their small group, a conversation that prioritized women art workers, their needs, thoughts, and aspirations. The collective shared the work of Southern women artists through exchange programs with galleries in New York, and they brought artists from across the country into Atlanta. AWAC founder Callahan McDonough meticulously documented and preserved the operations, correspondence, and financial records of the collective so that the existence and impact of AWAC might help to fill in the gaps in the historical record where women have been missing for so long. AWAC members used their moment in history to create something totally new in Atlanta. They called attention to the labor of women art workers and underscored its social and cultural value. Whether they did so consciously or as a consequence of achieving their mission to support women artists, AWAC art workers challenged a two-prong oppressive system, patriarchy and capitalism, while working as publicly funded artists. And with that, our examination of 1970s Atlanta as a time and place where artists briefly worked as public employees, in community, and in pursuit of what was in their best interests, comes to a close. Let's briefly summarize everything we've learned over the past few weeks. The state of Georgia is notoriously bad at funding the arts. In fact, it consistently ranks as the state that provides the least amount of funding. However, to this day, Atlanta provides direct support to artists as well as nonprofit arts organizations through grants, contracts, and workshops. These avenues of support were put in place by Maynard Jackson's administration in his first term as mayor of Atlanta. The three artist collectives we've explored here show what can happen when art workers band together through their shared interests and have the support of their communities behind them. In their own time, the Neighborhood Arts Center, the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition, and the Atlanta Women's Art Collective were some of the most active organizations in the Southeast. They received public funds to create public programming. They organized educational workshops for fellow artists, and they made their own work. They left a lasting impact on the city, even though the details of their specific achievements may be long forgotten. So much of Atlanta's art infrastructure was built by the Neighborhood Arts Center, the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition, and the Atlanta Women's Art Collective. SCAAW, the Arts Exchange, the Atlanta Jazz Festival, they were all born from the NAC. The Atlanta-based publication Art Papers would not exist without the Atlanta Art Workers Coalition. And the Atlanta Women's Art Collective held many groundbreaking exhibitions, and they brought many influential women artists from across the country to Atlanta for lectures and workshops that were open to the public. Many AWAC members have continued to serve the Atlanta arts community through positions in arts administration.
Some of our leaders say our country has to stop growing, that our children may have to accept a lower standard of living than we've had. Ronald Reagan doesn't buy that.
The arts must be supported, not only for themselves, but for the joy they bring to Americans everywhere. So I urge all of you here today to contact your friends, associates, and neighbors, to commit yourselves with corporations, foundations, and community groups to the private giving that we need to assure that art continues to play an integral part of our national life. You know, I've never been very good myself at fundraising, and I've told some of my friends on occasion that's why I got in government, because we don't ask for it, we just take it.
Conditions for art workers changed rapidly with the start of the Ronald Reagan administration in 1981. A letter from the Neighborhood Arts Center's deputy director to the commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs of the City of Atlanta, dated May 6, 1981, perfectly and heart-wrenchingly encapsulates the stress everyone was under as Reagan took office. The letter began, quote, "The Neighborhood Arts Center, like many other arts organizations, is experiencing the drastic CETA cuts, which will terminate the entire staff on May 31, end quote. The NAC deputy director, Glenda McGee, went on to ask Atlanta Commissioner and future Mayor Shirley Franklin if some grant money that was awarded to the Neighborhood Arts Center for programming could instead be transferred over to cover administrative staff salaries so that the center's operations could continue. The request was ultimately denied. It was a night and day change for artists, for Atlanta, and for people across the country. Art funding in the United States is deeply flawed. Wide public support for art workers has occurred two times in recent history, both in response to economic turmoil. One was the Works Progress Administration programs during the Great Depression, and the other came with the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act of 1973, which was passed in response to a national recession. This response to mass unemployment proves what appears to be so easily denied in more prosperous times, that artists are laborers who have a particular skill set but share the same material interests as the majority of workers in the United States. The value of art is built on a social agreement that art and culture are important. We all uphold this agreement, yet a majority of artists live in economic precarity. Under the economic system of capitalism, the question of how to pay artists for their work is left to philanthropy and the private sector to answer. But these systems need inequality to function. So much of the art world depends on wealthy art collectors who, by their very class status, do not share the same economic interests as the rest of us, to inflate the market value of a small number of artists, which then become the ones who are shown in galleries and museums, creating a high barrier to entry for other artists and reinforcing the tastes and inclinations of the wealthy onto the working classes. Philanthropists, to put it crassly, those with too much, benefit from those who don't have enough through tax-deductible giving, which hurts working people in two ways. It reinforces a system of reliance upon a small number of wealthy people, and the public lose out on foregone tax monies that instead make the already wealthy more wealthy. It is in the best interest of the private sector and the philanthropic shadow economy to preserve a certain level of inequality. In this system, the art worker, indeed all workers, face economic precarity. Under capitalism, artists are undervalued laborers because the drivers of capital cannot easily find ways to seize ownership of the art worker's means of production or to exploit the artist and maximize profits. In lieu of this, what is desired is a system that prioritizes equity and minimizes the wealth gap, where the value and resources produced by workers is distributed among them, one that is motivated by the health of people and planet rather than endless growth and profit, one where all workers know the value of their creative and material production. As it stands, the art market is one of the most unregulated, volatile economic sectors. It is based on arbitrary conceptions of artist notoriety and scarcity of artworks. It is insular and elitist, with a high barrier to entry. Rather than advocate for an overhaul of the economic and political system, which I am 100% for but is far beyond the scope of this project, the focus here has been on building an awareness among art workers, again, indeed, among all workers, of their shared economic interests and class status under capitalism, in the hope that this awareness will foster solidarity and build collective power. The ultimate goal is to inspire contemporary arts communities to reimagine the role of the artist and the function of art in our society, as these things will certainly help us to build a better one. That's it, folks. That's all I have for now. Thank you so much for listening. My research for this project was conducted at the Auburn Avenue Research Library on African American Culture and History, the Keenan Research Center at the Atlanta History Center, and the Museum of Contemporary Art of Georgia. Thank you so, so much to all the kind folks who work at these institutions. And thank you for listening.